Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Sometimes I have to just step aside and play you a speech that we all need to hear. This week, NASA's top climate scientist, Dr. James Hansen, says we are heading toward a hotter planet last experienced 55 million years ago. We may be able to avoid the worst by cutting greenhouse gas emissions within the next 10 years, he says. Without quick action, the big shift will be unavoidable. This speech was recorded in Houston, Texas on October 24, 2007. It comes to us through a San Francisco radio program called TUC Radio. It means Time of Useful Consciousness, and it's hosted by an independent journalist, Maria Gilardin. Maria finds the top scientists and the top stories. Be sure and support her work. As broadcast by Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, here is TUC Radio's presentation of Dr. James Hansen's important speech.
TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The threat to the planet. How can we avoid dangerous human-made climate change? Dr. James Hansen is one of the few scientists who have consistently warned that the impact that humans have on the climate is bringing about changes that are faster than we ever believed and may be irreversible if action is not taken now. Hansen is director of the NASA Institute for Space Studies in New York City. For 30 years, he has worked on studies of the Earth's climate. In this October 2007 talk, Hansen goes back into Earth's history, times when tectonic plates crashed into each other, and when the Himalayas and Andes mountain chains pushed up, to prove his point that the Earth, for several million years, and through dramatic cycles of ice ages and warm periods, existed in a changing energy balance in which the composition of the atmosphere, the effects of the oceans and polar ice sheets, and of the heat of the sun affected each other. Hansen says that these mechanisms that cause long-term climate change are now completely in the control of people. The unprecedented and rising amounts of greenhouse gases added each year, at the speed at which we are altering the energy balance of the Earth, are completely out of the range of proven Earth history of hundreds of thousands of years. Hansen fears that we may soon make these changes irreversible by reaching feedback mechanisms or tipping points, such as the melting of the ice sheets that has already begun on Greenland and West Antarctica. This is part one of a two-part program. In the second part, Hansen makes suggestions on how to deal with the danger. Here's Professor James Hansen carefully building his case by addressing the frequently asked question why we should worry about an average of 1 degree change and planetary temperature. He was recorded in Houston, Texas, where he received a standing ovation.
Thanks very much. It's an honor to speak here. And it's actually, Texas is a good place to speak. Texas is very much in the line of fire if climate change continues to accelerate. And Texas also could be a big part of the solution. Let me start by making note of the gap that exists between what is understood about global warming and what is known about global warming. I mean, what is understood by the relevant scientific community and what is known by those who need to know, and that's the public and policymakers. We really do have a planetary emergency, and it's hard for people to believe that because, you know, we don't see that much happening yet. But The thing is that the global warming due to the greenhouse gases that we've already added to the atmosphere has only been partly realized because the climate system has inertia. The ocean is 4 kilometers deep. It takes decades to just get half of the eventual response. And so there's more in the pipeline, even if we didn't add any more gases to the atmosphere. And we're going to add more because we've got all these vehicles on the road and power plants operating. And even when we decide there's a problem, we can't change that quickly. And there are positive feedbacks in the climate system. It didn't have to be that way. There are negative feedbacks also. But it turns out that positive feedbacks dominate. And the result is that there is the danger that we can pass certain tipping points at which little additional forcing is needed in order for large effects to proceed. And they could literally produce a different planet than the one that we have become accustomed to. But I should also emphasize equally that there's good news in the bad news, because what we've realized in just the last few years is that the dangerous level of greenhouse gases is much lower than we thought even several years ago. And it is technically feasible to keep carbon dioxide at a low level of 450 parts per million or even less. It's already increased from 280 parts per million 150 years ago to 383 parts per million now. But it is possible to keep it from increasing too much more. And having a low CO2 limit will allow us to avoid some things that we had begun to think were almost inevitable, like acidification of the ocean, which would destroy coral reefs, among other things. And there are benefits in terms of improved health and agricultural productivity. But the problem is that although the actions that are needed make good sense for many reasons, it's not going to be easy, because there are special financial interests which would prefer not to do those things yet until they've milked as much profit as they can. And it's going to be up to the public to put some pressure on the political system, and I think that's possible. So global warming in the last century is about 8/10 of a degree Celsius. That's about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And 3/4 of that warming has occurred in the last 30 years. You know, that doesn't sound like much. It's much, much smaller than the weather fluctuations that occur from one day to another. But it turns out it's very important. If you look at the United States, sometimes it's warmer than normal, sometimes it's colder than normal, averaged over a month. But if we average over several years, the first 6 years of this century, then the pattern of global warming becomes apparent. It's just what we expected it to be and what we calculate in global climate models. The warming is larger over land than it is over ocean, because the ocean has a lot of thermal inertia. It's only partially responded to the climate forcings. The warming is larger at high latitudes because there are positive feedbacks. When ice and snow melts, then the surface is darker and absorbs more sunlight, and that's a positive feedback. It's larger in the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere because there's more ocean in the southern hemisphere. And around Antarctica, the ocean mixes very deeply, so there's not much warming at the surface as yet. But I get emails from intelligent people who are still skeptical about whether we know what we're talking about on this, and doctors and lawyers and you know, isn't this just some sort of theory? The NASA administrator mentioned on National Public Radio. I think that's just an example of where a well-educated person, a very smart person, The head of the largest science agency in the world can ask this sort of question. Do we really need to wrestle with global warming? And there have been huge climate changes in the past, and, you know, isn't it arrogant to say that the present climate is the best climate? Well, it's actually the history of the Earth that is our best source of information on what the effect of different changes will be. This is the temperature in Antarctica as determined by an ice core drilled through the Antarctic ice sheet. The ice sheets on Antarctica and Greenland are formed by snowfall piling up year after year. It's too cold to have the snow melt, so it just piles up, and as it gets thicker and thicker, it has enough pressure to cause the snow at the bottom of the pile to compress into ice. And when it compresses into ice, it traps bubbles of air. The reason we take a core through the ice sheet is we can sample bubbles of air that were present in the atmosphere over this entire time period, which is more than 400,000 years. We get the temperature from the isotopic composition of the H2O, which tells us the temperature at which the snowflake formed that forms the ice sheet. And it's warmer. We've been living in this warm interglacial period now for more than 10,000 years. There have been previous interglacials, and during the ice ages, 20,000 years ago, it was a rather different planet. There was an ice sheet that covered all of Canada, reached down in Seattle, Minneapolis, New York, even into the Midwest. We were all under an ice sheet that was more than a mile thick. And sea level was about 400 feet lower than it is now. So coastal areas, the continental shelves all around the world, were exposed. But we can use the information from these ice cores and geologic information to deduce how sensitive the Earth's climate is to a climate forcing. A climate forcing is a imposed perturbation to the planet's energy balance, which would tend to change the planet's temperature. So, for example, if the sun became 1% brighter, that would be a forcing of a little more than 2 watts per meter squared, because the Earth absorbs about 238 watts per meter squared of sunlight averaged over the planet. So there were big changes associated with these climate variations. And I should say the temperature variations, which were about 10 degrees Celsius between the glacial periods and the interglacial periods at the South Pole and on Greenland at the high latitudes, they're about 3 or 4 degrees at the equator, and on the global average, about 5 degrees temperature change between the ice ages and the interglacial periods, 5 degrees Celsius, which is about 9 degrees Fahrenheit. There are big changes associated with that. As I mentioned, sea level changed by more than 100 meters between the last ice age and today, but for the last approximately 7,000 years, sea level has been stable. And that had a noticeable effect. It's probably not an accident that all of the first urban areas originated on coastlines between 7,000 and 5,000 years ago, after sea level stabilized. And the thought is that as long as sea level was going up 1 or 2 meters every 100 years, the biological productivity was small in the coastal areas. But once sea level stabilized, then the vegetation, the biology developed, and a fish resource existed, and it provided the protein and the food which allowed urban areas to come in to being around the world. The only exception, I think, was Jericho, which was inland. But in any case, there are big changes between the current interglacial warm period and the last ice age. And the changes that maintain this planetary temperature change of 5 degrees Celsius have to be forcings either in the amount of incoming energy, but we know that the sun, although it changes slowly in its brightness over time, over millions of years. On this short a time scale, its change is negligible.
This is Radio EcoShock, and we're listening to Dr. James Hansen of NASA with the latest climate science, as presented by Maria Gallardin of TUC Radio in San Francisco. This is Co-op Radio, listener-supported radio coming out of Vancouver for the last 30 years, CFRO 102.7 FM.
But within the atmosphere, the long-lived greenhouse gases are more abundant during the Ice Age, and that provides a forcing because they trap the infrared heat radiation, and that affects the planet's energy balance. In addition, the ice sheets themselves have an effect on the planet's energy balance because these large ice sheets reflect sunlight, and that reduces the heating of the planet. And the total forcing by the surface albedo changes, the surface reflectivity change due to the ice sheets and the vegetation changes and the greenhouse gases gives you a forcing of about 6.5 watts per meter squared, which maintain this temperature difference of about 5 degrees, which implies that the sensitivity of the climate system, if you give it a long time to respond, is about 0.75 degrees Celsius for each watt of forcing. And we can now check that, although that was determined by just looking at two points in time, the last ice age, 20,000 years ago, and the present interglacial period. But we now have a record of sea level for this entire 400,000-year period. And that tells us how big the ice sheets were, because the water that's not in the ocean, the reason it's not there is because it's forming these ice sheets on the continents. And the ice sheets get bigger in both horizontal dimensions as well as thicker. And so we can calculate the climate forcing due to the change in the ice sheet area based on this sea level record. And we also can calculate the climate forcing due to greenhouse gases because we have this record of how these gases changed based on the bubbles of air in the ice sheets. And then we calculate a temperature for the last 400,000 years, and it turns out it's in very good agreement with observations of the temperature, the observations being the Antarctic temperature divided by 2 because the amplitude of the glacial to interglacial changes is about twice as large at the poles as it is on the global average. So the mechanisms that cause the long-term temperature changes, climate changes, are the changes, the surface albedo, and the changes in the atmospheric greenhouse gases. Well, those mechanisms are now completely under the control of humans. The greenhouse gases are now increasing to levels far outside the range that has existed in millions of years. Ice is melting all over the planet. Both of those mechanisms are now moving in the direction of creating a warmer planet. And the planet has only partly responded because of the inertia of the system and because there are other human-made forcings in addition to greenhouse gases. So humans are now in control of the mechanisms for global climate change, for better or worse. Now, the changes in greenhouse gases are due to exchange of the greenhouse gases between the surface reservoirs. There's carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, in the ocean, in the soils, and in the biology, in the biosphere. And that can change as the climate changes, and that's why it's a feedback. So as the climate gets warmer, for example, then the ocean gives up carbon dioxide, just like your Pepsi gives up carbon dioxide when it gets warmer. So that's an exchange of the gases among these surface reservoirs. But there also can be exchange of carbon dioxide with the Earth itself, with the solid Earth. And that is important on long time scales. On the long time scales, the mechanisms that take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and put it in the Earth are primarily weathering. As mountains are pushed up and weather, and as the silicate material is weathered by the action of water and carbon dioxide, which makes carbonic acid, but the eventual product of weathering is carbonate sediments on the ocean floor. And that takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And that's responsible for about 80% of the flux of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere into the ocean surface, into the earth. The other 20% comes from the burial of organic matter. And eventually some of that organic matter becomes fossil fuels. But the return path of the buried carbon occurs as ocean floor, carbonate-rich ocean floor, is subducted under the continent. As the continent moves, the ocean floor goes under the continent, and the higher temperature and pressure causes these reactions that cause metamorphism of the carbonates to other forms of rock, basalt and other forms, and carbon dioxide is released, and it comes from through volcanoes back to the atmosphere and also from related phenomena such as seltzer springs. So if you're in a period of strong mountain building and rapid weathering, then you can take the CO2 out of the atmosphere relatively rapidly. But if you're in a period when there's a lot of subduction of ocean floor, carbonate-rich ocean floor, then you can have strong emissions of CO2. Well, if we look at the history of the Earth, 250 million years ago, the continents were stuck together in Pangaea. But by 65 million years ago, the continents had broken up essentially into the present continents. They were not yet separated by as much as they are now, but they were at approximately the latitudes that they are now. So I particularly like to look at this period from 65 million years ago to the present, because the brightness of the sun is increasing with time. The sun is a normal main sequence star. It's burning hydrogen, converting hydrogen to helium in nuclear fusion, and it's getting brighter with time, so that 4.5 billion years ago, the sun was about 30% dimmer than it is now. But 65 million years ago, it was only 0.5% dimmer. So 0.5% of 200 is about 1 watt per meter squared, is the increase in climate forcing due to the sun getting brighter during this period. So any climate forcings either have to be due to changes in the energy coming in, or changes in the atmosphere, or changes at the surface. Well, at the surface, there is some forcing because the continents were not in the same position, and the oceans are much darker than the land, and so that affects how much energy is absorbed by the surface. But that also is pretty small because the continents are almost in their present positions. It's only of the order of 1 watt per meter squared. But we know that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has changed from, it was 65 million years ago, it's between 1,000 and 2,000 parts per million. Now, recently, it's been varying between 180 parts per million in the ice ages to 280 parts per million in the interglacial periods, so that the total variation involves more than three doublings. So it's a forcing of more than 10 watts per meter squared. So the dominant forcing that affects climate change over this time period is changes in the atmospheric composition. We know pretty much what went on 65 million years ago. India, the one change that was significantly different, India was still south of the equator, but it was moving north at a high rate of speed, about 15 centimeters per year, which is about 0.5 foot per year. And Eurasia was retreating at a rate of about 1 or 2 centimeters per year. But that means that 50 million years ago, India rear-ended Asia and has been pushing against Asia ever since, pushing up the Himalaya Mountains and pushing up the Tibetan Plateau. And this huge area
has been the greatest area of weathering as this fresh rocks keeps getting pushed up. So in the period between 65 million years ago and 50 million years ago, when India crashed into Asia, the Tethys Ocean, which is the ocean in between India and Asia and in between the African plate and the Eurasian plate, that Tethys Ocean had been getting sediments for a long time, and so it had very carbonate-rich ocean floor. And as that was subducted in this continental drift process, it was pushing out, it was sending out a lot of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and the planet was getting warmer. The temperature in the deep ocean today is about 0 degrees, but at that time, 50 million years ago, 65 to 50 million years ago, there was no ice on the planet. It was a much warmer planet. The deep ocean was about 10 degrees Celsius, much warmer than now. But after the Himalayas starting going up and the Alps were growing also, the planet, the weathering brought down the amount of carbon dioxide, and the planet steadily cooled off until it reached a point where it was cool enough that ice could begin to form on Antarctica. In the last 15 million years, the planet has been cooling off quite rapidly. So the bottom line from this long time scale climate information is that indeed, there are very large climate changes, larger even than we expect humans to cause. But the dominant forcing causing those was, in fact, changes in atmospheric carbon dioxide, huge changes of it. But this natural rate of change is only about 100 parts per million per million years, or about 1/10,000th of a part per million per year. So the exchange of carbon dioxide between the atmosphere and the solid earth is a very slow process. Humans are increasing the amount of CO2 by 2 parts per million per year, which is more than 10,000 times faster than the natural process. So again, it shows that humans are now much more powerful than the natural processes.
That was part one of an hour-long speech by Professor James Hansen, Director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies and Adjunct Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University. Hansen was trained in physics and astronomy in the space science program of Dr. James Van Allen. Since the late 1970s, he has worked on studies of the Earth's climate in order to understand the human impact on global climate. Hansen was censored by the White House, prevented from speaking to the media, or ignored. Hundreds of thousands of dollars, mostly oil money, were spent to discredit him. He has stood his ground. He spoke in Houston, Texas, and at the University of Montana at the end of October 2007. When TUC Radio returns, you will hear Hansen's proposals for change. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org for more information and links to Hansen's work.
This is Radio EcoShock, and we're listening to Dr. James Hansen of NASA with the latest climate science as presented by Maria Gallardin of TUC Radio in San Francisco. You are tuned to the Big Vancouver Sound of CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Get it on cable, get it on satellite, get it on the net at CFRO 102.7 FM or co-opradio.org.
TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The Threat to the Planet. How can we avoid dangerous human-made climate change? This is part two of a one-hour speech by one of the great climate scientists of our time. Dr. James Hansen has consistently warned that the impact that humans have on the climate is bringing about changes that are faster than we ever believed and may be irreversible if action is not taken now. He was censored by the White House, prevented from speaking to the media, or ignored. Attempts to discredit him came from well-funded think tanks, whose names you can find on the internet by entering James Hansen's name into a search engine. Hansen is director of the NASA Institute for Space Studies in New York City, and he teaches at Columbia University. Since the late 1970s, he has worked on studies of the Earth's climate. In part one of this talk, Hansen gave a vivid account of the climate history of the Earth, making the case that mechanisms that caused major climate change in the past are now manipulated by humans. The process behind the much-censored expression, anthropogenic climate change. Here is Dr. James Hansen, recorded in October 2007.
I want to now look at the time period that you can think about more easily, the last 100 years. There are several things that are changing on this time scale. The most largest forcing is the increasing greenhouse gases. But also, you know, a volcano, when the volcanoes go off, Krakatoa and Mount Agung and El Chichon and Pinatubo, the small particles it puts in the stratosphere reflect sunlight and cause a cooling effect. If we add up all these different forcings, put them in a global climate model, the temperature change that you get is in good agreement with the observed global surface temperature change, including things like when the volcanoes go off, it got cooler. So it suggests we can use these models to then extend the runs into the future and see what will be the effect of continuing to emit greenhouse gases. And if we follow business as usual, which is continued burning of more and more fossil fuels each year, we follow a path which gives us of the order of 3 degrees Celsius additional global warming by the end of the century. I also try to define another scenario in which we slow down carbon dioxide emissions by a few tens of percent by the middle of the century on a global average, and we stabilize atmospheric composition by the end of the century, and that keeps additional global warming less than 1 degree Celsius. And I have some arguments as to why we will have to do that if we want to avoid large climate impacts. You know, all of the nations in the world agreed in the Framework Convention on Climate Change in 1992, which was signed by the United States and something like 180 other countries, that we should stabilize atmospheric composition at a level that avoids dangerous anthropogenic effects. The problem is that no one has defined what that means. What is the dangerous level? Well, I think that two irreversible effects should have special weight, and one of them is ice sheet disintegration, because if that happens, it's irreversible on timescales of less than many thousands of years. It takes thousands or tens of thousands of years to build these Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets. And we can't even think of, you know, 1,000 years is 30 generations, and nobody thinks that far ahead. So if we destroy an ice sheet, the sea level change is going to be more or less permanent as far as we're concerned. And likewise, the extermination of species is practically irreversible. I mean, there have been periods in the Earth's history when we had rapid global warmings and more than half the species on the planet went extinct. Well, other species came into being, but it took hundreds of thousands or millions of years for that to happen. And again, that's not a time scale which is of interest to humanity, I think.
And there are also regional climate disruptions which are very important. To start with the sea level, we now see that the areas on Greenland and West Antarctica, the areas of summer melt are increasing. They fluctuate from year to year, but there's a trend toward having bigger and bigger areas of ice melt. And that summer melt does not go off the edge of the ice sheet. It finds a low spot and it burrows a hole that goes all the way to the base of the ice sheet. And there it lubricates the ice sheet and increases the discharge of these giant icebergs to the ocean. There had been some question about, well, global warming also increases the snowfall at the center of the ice sheet, and so which is the bigger effect? Well, we know which is the bigger effect because we now have this spectacular satellite, GRACE, gravity satellite, that measures the gravitational field of the Earth to such a high accuracy that we see that during the winter the ice sheet gets heavier and then it loses mass during the warm seasons. But overall, there's a decrease, which is now at a rate of about 150 cubic kilometers per year on Greenland and a similar rate on West Antarctica. The rate of sea level rise is now 3.5 centimeters per decade. But the 3.5 centimeters is double what it was 15 years ago, and that was double what it was a century earlier. And the danger is the disintegration of an ice sheet is a wet process, and if it once gets started, it can proceed very rapidly. The last time that an ice sheet disintegrated was 14,000 years ago. Sea level went up 20 meters in 400 years, which is 1 meter every 20 years. And that would be an almost inconceivable disaster. And the last time that the planet was 3 degrees Celsius warmer, which is what we expect at the end of this century if we follow business as usual, the last time it was that warm, sea level was 25 meters higher, which is 80 feet. And there are more than 1 billion people who live within 25 meters elevation of sea level. But even a few meters would be important. It would cover most of Bangladesh and a large fraction of Florida. China has like 300 million people who are living within 25 meter elevation of sea level. So it's something we really have to avoid. And, you know, more than half of the cities in the world are on coastlines. We've just set up our civilization that way for many different reasons. We don't really have the ability to accurately compute exactly when ice sheets will disintegrate because it's a very nonlinear process. But I think there's no doubt we would get big effects this century if we follow business as usual. From the Earth's history, as I mentioned earlier, when the planet had warmings of several degrees Celsius, even though those occurred more slowly than the present one, it caused the extinction of a large fraction of the species on the planet. So for that reason, if we want to preserve most of the species of creation, we're going to need to avoid warming of several degrees. Now, the key fact, which is not widely appreciated about the carbon cycle, when we put a pulse of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, a fraction of that disappears quite rapidly. Within 25 years, about half of the CO2 has disappeared. It's been taken up by sinks, mainly by the ocean. But then the uptake slows down, so that after 100 years, a third of it is still in the atmosphere. And after 1,000 years, a fifth of it is still in the atmosphere. What happens is the CO2 that goes into the ocean exerts a back pressure on the atmosphere and doesn't let the rest of the CO2 in until the CO2 in the ocean, some of it has sedimented out. And that takes thousands of years. So the upshot of that is we cannot afford to put all of the carbon of all the fossil fuels into the atmosphere. There's enough CO2 in oil and gas to take us up to at least approximately the dangerous level, if not somewhat beyond it. And it's going to be practically impossible to prevent putting this oil, or most of it, a large part of it, into the atmosphere, because it's used in vehicles and ways in which you cannot capture it. And there's enough coal to make a totally different planet. We could send it back to when there was no ice on the planet if we decided to put all of this in the atmosphere and wait a while. So the practical solution is to say, well, let's decide only to use coal at power plants and capture the CO2 and sequester it, put it back where it came from, into the ground. That is technically possible. You know, we would have to, in addition to having a moratorium on new coal-fired power plants until we have the technology to capture the CO2 and sequester it, but we'd also have to agree to phase out the existing ones over the next few decades and replace them with modern technology or a different form of energy. But it's also, the other 20% of the solution is we're going to have to stretch the conventional oil and gas. And the way you would do that is provide the incentive by putting a price on carbon emissions, either a cap and trade or a tax system or allowances. There are various ways you can do this to make it a fair way of doing it, but you have to put some price to provide an economic incentive to drive energy efficiency and to drive the renewable energy technologies and other forms of energy that do not produce CO2. And it's, in terms of responsibility for the climate change, it is not the current rate of emissions that determines that. It is the cumulative emissions over time, because the CO2 stays in the atmosphere for a very long time. Although China is now passing us in current emissions, we are responsible for more than 3 times more climate change than any other country. And Germany, UK, and the rest of Europe are responsible for about 30%. So it's the developed world that's responsible for the climate change. And if you looked at per capita emissions, we have, even today with China with equal emissions, we still have more than 5 times more emissions per person. So, is it feasible to have a scenario that would avoid dramatic climate changes? Well, it's technically feasible. If we phased out the old power plants over the period 25 to 2050, then say we started with developed countries having no more new coal-fired power plants that don't sequester by 2012, and developing countries by 2022, giving the developing countries 10 years additional, the same way that we did in the Montreal Protocol for the ozone problem and chlorofluorocarbon phase out. With that scenario, we would keep carbon dioxide from exceeding about 450 parts per million. If we don't have that phase out, then we're going to more than double the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and we guarantee climate disasters. But in addition to that primary requirement, there's also this need to stretch the supplies of oil and gas to give us time to develop the technologies beyond fossil fuels. And we're going to have to do that anyway. Fossil fuels are not going to last forever. Oil is probably already close to its peak production and is going to begin to decline. So we're going to have to figure out ways that are not fossil fuel based. And to give us time to do that, it makes sense to stretch those supplies, to use that valuable resource more sensibly. Otherwise, we're going to end up in a situation where we begin to this addiction to fossil fuels, which now everybody's willing to admit we have, will cause irrational behavior where we begin to try to squeeze oil out of tar shale. You can cook the Rocky Mountains and squeeze some, drip some oil out of it, out of the tar shale. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to do that. You produce twice as much carbon dioxide in doing that. It's very energy inefficient. And what's it going to do? It's only going to give you a little bit longer with fossil fuels. So you've got to figure out a way to get beyond fossil fuels. So that means we'd better stretch the conventional, easily available oil and gas, because we really can't go beyond that. And the thing is that the situation that you will get to is in many ways much more desirable than the one we have now, because you'll have a cleaner atmosphere. Right now, not only we're polluting the atmosphere, but also the ocean. The mercury is being put in the ocean through the burning of these fossil fuels. And so there are other advantages in reducing this pollution for agricultural productivity and human health. So why don't we do that? Well, I think that the reason is that the special interests have had a special role in our government. And if we want politicians to help us solve this problem, we've got to have more impact on them than the special interests do. And I think we can do that. I think the democracy still works, but we have to make use of it.
You're tuned to CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. This is Radio EcoShock, and we're listening to Dr. James Hansen of NASA with the latest climate science, as presented by Maria Gallardin of TUC Radio in San Francisco.
You know, I even think we could save the Arctic, because right now the planet is out of energy balance by something between half a watt and 1 watt per meter squared. But in addition to stabilizing CO2, we could reduce methane, CFCs, tropospheric ozone, and black soot. And there's enough forcing in these other non-CO2 forcings that we could, I think, restore the planetary energy balance, and then the inertia to melt more and more ice is no longer there. But we would have to have a concerted effort to do that, and it would have to be an international effort. And, you know, I think we're almost certainly going to pass the dangerous level of CO2 in the atmosphere, because the system just doesn't react until it sees the problem. It can't seem to do it based on scientific expectations. And that means we're going to probably have to try to figure out how to draw some of the CO2 out of the atmosphere. And that is possible to some degree if we only moderately pass the dangerous level. And I like this idea of, since I'm from the Midwest, that the Midwest could come to the rescue of the coastal states by growing biofuels. And I don't mean corn-based ethanol, which is not a good idea. It uses as much energy as it provides you, and it raises the price of food all around the world. But there are natural grasses, switchgrass, and possibly even some better ones that are being worked on, which, if you farm them in an optimum way with no-till agriculture, so that you're actually storing more carbon in the soil as well as taking carbon out of the atmosphere into these into the biofuels, and then you burn the biofuels in a power plant and you capture the CO2 and sequester it. And so you can actually draw down the amount of CO2. So the summary is, alternative scenario is feasible, and it has other advantages, but it's not being pursued. We really have to get going now. And we did this once with the previous planetary emergency, when it was realized that chlorofluorocarbons may cause a problem. We stopped building any more CFC plants and just kept the production constant. And then when the ozone hole was discovered, the Montreal Protocol was reached, and developing countries were given an extra 10 years, and the production went down, and the problem is in the process of being solved. But that was a success story. Scientists gave a clear warning. The media transmitted the message, and the public did a good job of encouraging it to happen. And the DuPont, for several years, argued that the science was wrong, but then they changed their mind and they started to develop new chemicals that didn't produce chlorine. And the U.S., leadership from the U.S. was key to getting the Montreal Protocol to happen. But in the case of global warming, I think that we haven't made clear, the scientists haven't made clear, that we're really talking about a different planet if we don't do something. And I think the special interests have had a big impact on the media and on the government. And as a result, the public has not been fully informed. The problem is, all of these parties may bear blame, but the ones who are going to pay are going to be our children and our grandchildren. There's a tremendous generational inequity in what is happening. And so the bottom line is that we need urgent action, and most important of all the actions is a moratorium on new coal-fired power plants. And that's just not understood. For example, Germany is probably the greenest country around now, but it has decided to phase out nuclear power and build coal-fired power plants. And it doesn't realize that coal is different than oil. The oil is going to get, the CO2 is going to get up there anyway, this year or next year or the following year. But the coal, it's possible that it should never get up there. And it had better not, because if the coal CO2 gets up there also, then we're in trouble. Problem is, now you hear a lot about this global warming, but you don't hear solutions. You only hear marginal actions. Replacing your light bulb is not going to solve the problem. It helps stretch it is helpful for the second action, stretching the current supplies. But unless you have these two major things, a phase out of coal and a carbon price that encourages the energy efficiency and the renewable energies, it's not going to solve the problem. And so I recommend that what has to be done is that the candidates for office should be asked if they will support a declaration of stewardship for the earth and creation. And that the most important one is this moratorium on dirty coal, but there's also, and this is a very hard one for any politician to say that he will do, because the price, it can be done in different ways. You can make it fair, but you can have rations, and so the little guy won't be hurt. There are different ways to do this, but you've got to have a price or it's not going to work, and if you don't admit that, then you're not being honest. And, you know, in order to make this work, in order not to have an economic problem, you should really take sensible actions that encourage efficiency. There should be building standards. Buildings could now be 50% more efficient, and builders prefer not to do that because it makes the building a little more expensive, which more than pays for itself over the length of a person's mortgage, but the builder still doesn't want to do that. If you don't have the regulation, he doesn't seem to want to do that. And appliances and vehicles should have efficiency standards, and you should change the rules so that utilities don't make more profit if they sell more energy. They should make more profit if they help us find ways to conserve energy. So there are things like that that need to be done. And finally, the status of the matter is the climate situation has really become clear, even though you still hear these arguments because the special interests are trying to pretend that we don't understand the science. But the truth is we do, and we're getting very close to tipping points. And solution is feasible, and it makes sense. You know, economically it makes good sense because it will produce high-tech, high-paid jobs, which are even better than coal mining. It would give us the technology to sell to other countries, because China is going to need this, and we can get some of our money back that we're sending over there. And so, but the problem is, I just think that special interests have too big a say. Democracy is supposed to be one person, one vote, but in Washington, some people have more influence than others. I consider myself a conservative. I'm not a Democrat or Republican. I'm an independent, but I come from Iowa, and I consider myself in most ways conservative, and I don't understand why. It really should not be a political issue. It should, anyone who wants to preserve creation, the planet that we've known for the length of civilization, should be in favor of doing something about climate change. And I think young people need to understand this and make clear, you know, to their parents. So, because parents are very busy with all the other problems we have with health care and every other thing, but they don't have time to study this problem. But we need to make clear that, you know, our children and grandchildren are the ones that are going to suffer if we don't do something about this. And what you have to watch is not the words, because now politicians and even businesses start to say green things, but you have to really watch their deeds. You'll see advertisements from some oil companies or something that say they're becoming green, but if you look at how their money is invested, if they're still just sticking in fossil fuels and not trying to become energy companies, then don't believe them. They're not really part of the solution. They're still the problem. Thanks.
That was a standing ovation for Dr. James Hansen, director of the NASA Institute for Space Studies in New York City. Hansen was elected to the prestigious National Academy of Sciences in 1995. The president of the Academy called him recently one of the most productive and creative scientists in the world. In spite, or maybe because of that reputation, administrations since the 1980s have censored him. You heard the second part of a one-hour talk recorded in October 2007. Thanks to Mark Lacey and the Progressive Forum in Houston and the Presentation and Technology Services Department of the University of Montana for the recordings of this lecture. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org for more information and links to Hansen's work. Please find a pen to write down a phone number to call to find out how to order or download the talk by Dr. James Hansen. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or audio tape order or donation is our only support and is essential in keeping TUC Radio on the air. Call toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. This toll-free number only works from inside the U.S. For calls from Canada and other countries, use the country code plus 415-861-4583. That's 415 for San Francisco, followed by 861-4583. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.
You just heard Dr. James Hansen of NASA, presented by Maria Gilardin of TUC Radio in San Francisco. Thank you, Maria, for permission to distribute this speech widely, and please support this top-notch independent journalist in her work. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Join us next week for more on the ecological crisis of our times. And you can find the latest speech by James Lovelock to the British Royal Academy on October 29th at our website, www.ecoshock.org. In fact, we have gigabytes of free green radio as MP3 files in our audio on demand menu. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. Get the facts and get going with Radio EcoShock. Thanks so much for listening.